It was a ritual walk across the Cairngorm Massif from south to north, following the old ways. It was made in memory of my grandfather, who had died on the far side of the mountains, and to whose funeral I was walking. David was with me again, and as we walked together up the valley of Glen Tilt, midges clouded the air, encouraging us onwards. Wherever my grandfather had gone in his remarkable life, he had walked. He had been a diplomat and mountaineer. In Bulgaria in 1940, only a few weeks before the country joined the Axis and banished its British diplomats, he was busy exploring the Rila Mountains. In 1943, he and a climber friend reached the summit of Demir Kurzak in the Turkish Aladar. They thought themselves the first summiteers, but then found a tattered swastika flag left there by an Austrian party several years earlier. The posting he longed for but never got was to Tehran. The politics of Iran fascinated him, but its mountains, rearing snowbound over the city, fascinated him even more. After retirement, he and my grandmother settled in a former forestry cottage near the village of Tomintul, just to the northeast of the Cairngorms proper. The River Tilt was glimpsed through evergreens and birch. The sound of an engine behind us, then the honk of a horn, an estate Land Rover bouncing past, hardly slowing to let us leave the track. The back of the vehicle was open but caged. Two sad-faced young men in flat caps gazed out at us, without changing their expressions, as they trundled on up the valley. Apprentice gillies, I guessed, but they looked like inmates being transported between penitentiaries. A mile further on, we passed the estate shooting lodge. Four men, presumably clients, stood talking 100 yards away under a larch. I raised a hand, called a brief greeting. They paused their conversation, looked blankly at us, resumed talking. It felt as if we had stumbled into an episode of The Prisoner, and I was glad to get away from the estate roads and out onto the unmetalled footpaths and former drove paths of the Upper Tilt. There are few highland glens that were not used at one point as a route for the drovers. We stopped to rest by a long river pool among the dotted ruins of former shilings, the huts or shelters constructed near pasture. A big salmon leapt from the water and flopped back with a splash like a dropped log. A dipper in his pianist's white bib whirred upstream from rock to rock, then dived. David stripped and bathed in the pool, letting the river rinse away the morning's miles. He swam out to a flat boulder that lay just beneath the water and assumed the lotus position upon it, perched miraculously on the water's surface like a yogi, grinning. But soon the midges moved us on, a robust encouragement to all-day walking. The Cairngorms are a landscape on which both history and snow, perhaps the two substances my grandfather loved most, lay thickly. This was why, after he had left the diplomatic service, he and my grandmother settled there. Climatically speaking, the Cairngorms are Britain's Arctic. In winter, storm winds of up to 170 miles per hour rasp the upper shires of the range, and avalanches scour its lee slopes. My grandparents saw the tremble of the aurora borealis from the north windows of their house, billowing curtains of green or, more rarely, red light. In places on the summit plateau of the massif, the wind blows so hard and insistently that vegetation exists in bonsai form. Pine trees grow to just a few inches high. There are dwarf willows, and a miniature creeping azalea called Loiseluria procumbens, which became one of my grandfather's favourite alpine plants, forms mats barely an inch high among the pebbles, keeping its head down, staying prostrate. Procumbens. The massif is a terrain shaped by what Nan Shepherd once called the elementals. Anna Nan Shepherd, was born in Aberdeen in 1893, and during her long life she, like my grandparents, spent hundreds of days and covered thousands of miles exploring the Cairngorms on foot. Her reputation as a writer rests on the three novels she published, but to my mind, her most important work is her least known, an 80-page prose meditation on the Cairngorms, and more generally on our relationship with landscape, called The Living Mountain. Better than anyone else I have read, Shepherd recounted the power of the Highland landscape to draw people into intimacy with it, and showed how particular places might make possible particular thoughts. Slowly and effortfully, my grandparents acquired an intimacy with the Cairngorms. They often came to striking accommodations and compromises with the terrain. Where they encountered erratics, boulders carried by the glaciers, so heavy they couldn't be shifted, my grandmother built rock gardens around them and grew alpine succulents between them. It was, though, always a struggle to manage the incursions of wild nature, the snow that drifted to 10 feet against the sides of the house in deep winter, the deer and rabbits that ate the seedlings, the family of pine martens that one year nested in the roof and liked to play in my grandmother's underwear drawer. The Larrig Grew is the great glacier-gouged valley that divides the Cairngorm Massif from north to south, and whose highest point is higher than the summits of most British mountains. Entering the Grew from north or south, I have always had the feeling of crossing a portal or border. People have died in the Larrig Grew, and more have died on the summits to either side of it. One of Shepherd's own students perished in a blizzard, far out of her path, her body found months after her death, once the drifts had thawed. Through the droving centuries, the Larrig Grew was the main route across the Massif, taking cattle down through Glen Lhuy and then on south to Bray Mawr. Sheep coming from Skye would occasionally be driven across the pass, and its last recorded use as a drove route was in 1873. It posed problems to the drovers, however, in terms of distance, severity of weather, and ground underfoot. Each winter brought fresh stonefall from the surrounding crags, and the upper reaches of the pass became strewn with leg-breaking boulders, ill-suited to the hooves and long legs of cattle. So late each spring, men were sent up to the high passes to shift the boulders and open the path. David and I entered the Larrig Grew from the south, moving up and over the pink flat steps of granite down which the young River Dee split and tripped. We passed between the gatekeeper peaks of the valley, Devil's Point to the west, with its diagonal flashings of scree, and the black flank of Carnarvon to the east, down which a thin line of white water was crashing thousands of feet above us. Both peaks loomed, close and intimidating, and I felt the signal prickle of entering a wild space. Then we were through the portal, over the border, and into the pass proper. On the valley floor flourished a fragrant and complex ground cover, bog myrtle, bog asphodel, juniper with its ginny scent, the creeping azalea, dwarf pine trees, saxifrages, bilberry and ling. I began to gather bunches of Cairngorm flora, one to place on my grandfather's coffin, and one to burn on the summit pass. Where the river swung close to the path, we stopped and bathed our feet in its pools. The midges still smoked the air, still maddened us. So it was up and on for another 4 or 5 miles, towards the high point of the Grew, the pass itself. David walked ahead, and, left alone, I was struck suddenly by a hammer blow of sadness. Looking west, I saw the snows of Breiriach. In the shaded northeast, facing corries and crags of that great mountain, old snow often lies all year round. It's a reminder that winter never really leaves the Cairngorms, or rather that this is the point from which the cold musters itself again each year, and out of which it pours. A reminder, too, that the summit of Larigru was, 12,000 years ago, not a watershed, but an ice shed, the point from which the glaciers crept seawards to north and south, scouring out the shape of the highland landscape we now know, scavenging into the granite. Granite was my grandfather's best-loved rock. Over the course of his 80s, he got less and less often to the granite, felt less often the fire of the rock and the fire of the sun. He gave up the summits for the passes, then the passes for the valleys, and at last the valleys for the limestone land around the house. He could only walk in memory the roots in the Cairngorms that he knew so well underfoot. Even in his 90s, however, he was occasionally to be found on his old cross-country skis, long, heavy wooden skis, made in Austria in the 1930s, sliding up and down the driveway. As we approached the summit, the beaten earth track narrowed to a slender thread and disappeared altogether into the wilderness of a boulder field. Then I saw the path. A faint line of rosy granite, scoured from the brown patina of the boulders by the passage of feet and crampons. The track led us to the pools of Dee, two tiny lochans, whose water falls as rain and snow, and is filtered by the granite of the pass. That day, transparent and reflective, they appeared like the mountain's own eyes, gazing skywards. I stood by the edge of the first one. The stones in its shallows seemed set beneath glass. Green weed on its floor caught the light and sent it back. I stooped and dipped a hand through the mirror, the water binding cold to my fingers. The final half mile up to the watershed, heavy legs, slow feet, a blue dusk starting to haze the air, the terrain narrowing, funneling down, perception gradually squeezed, sightlines narrowed, vision diminished. And then suddenly the pass was reached, and the world yawned open ahead, pine-forested northern lands spread out ahead and below us. I placed my handful of bog myrtle, azalea, juniper and dry heather on a natural ortholith of granite, and set them alight. A brief flare of orange in the dusk. A beacon fire at the pass.